Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Authentic Woman. This is your host, Shannon Fisher, and I'm excited to be kicking off the summer season, doing a special July 4th weekend show, and I can't think of a better guest to have than the one I have today. His name is Harvey J. Kay, and he has written a book about America's greatness, kind of how it came to be and what threatens it in today's world. He is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And today we will be discussing his provocative book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. So, Harvey, welcome.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be talking to you. And just for the sake of the audience, when I think of American greatness, I do not think of Donald Trump's rendition of it.
Absolutely. Yes, he co-opted that word. And I think that was not something that most people are on board with.
The intellectual side of me actually thinks that that was a brilliant coup on his part, maybe one of the smarter things he's done. But it's not the kind of version of greatness that I ever had in my mind.
Well, you are a historian, and I love talking to historians because they say that the best predictor of the future is the past. And it seems that we're indeed right now experiencing something similar to history repeating itself in modern American politics. And so your book takes us back 80 years and examines in depth the contributions that were made by America's greatest generation and what it is that they did to earn that moniker. So to start off, for any listeners who might not know, what is the greatest generation?
It's a great place to start, because for those who are fully adult, when you say greatest generation, their minds immediately go to World War II. And there's no doubt about the importance of World War II and in the shaping of this generation. And similarly, no doubt about the role of the men and women in winning the Second World War, defending American democracy and enhancing it in the course of doing so. But the greatest generation is actually a bigger concept or bigger idea or bigger experience than that. And that's pretty much the arc of my book, you might say. And that is, and you actually introduced it when you said 80 years ago, because if we go 80 years back, we go back to the mid-1930s, to the time of the Great Depression and the New Deal and the Roosevelt presidency. So let's think about this generation as teenagers, very young adults in the middle of the Great Depression, confronting the Great Depression. And then within several years, what Roosevelt called the rendezvous of destiny, World War II. And when they come out of the war, they're probably about 25 years of age. Now we're 1945. 10 years later, 1955, they're 35 years of age. I don't mean to be pedantic about it, but as we go through, let's remember that in 1965, when I was just a teenager, that generation was 45 years old. Mm-hmm. So when we think about the greatest generation, we really should think about it not in terms of a singular experience, World War II, but as an arc going from the Great Depression and the New Deal and the struggles to for economic recovery and advancing reforms through the winning of World War II and then the remaking of America in many ways, remaking America and the world in certain fashion in the wake of that World War and the incredible economic boom that generation took part in and helped to generate. And I was born in 1949. My own generation tends to think of the 60s as our own because, of course, we were teenagers and young adults and we were rambunctious. And, you know, we invented, as I tell my students, sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Sure.
You know, we fought for civil rights and we opposed the war. We think of the 60s as our own. But if you actually think about the 60s, when this generation is now in their mid-40s, for all of their sins and all their faults and failings, this was actually the generation that enacted civil rights and voting rights, immigration reform, Medicare and Medicaid, environmental safety, environmental controls and regulations, workplace and consumer safety, all of these things that we came to benefit from. There's this arc from the time of the mid-30s right through the 1960s. So this generation, the greatest generation, is not only great because they took part in and if you like, beat fascism and won the Second World War along with their allies. They confronted and transcended the Depression, won World War II, transformed in a decidedly fabulous, enriching way the United States during the 1950s. In the 1960s, when they reached their maturity, and I don't mean elderly maturity, I mean 45 years of age. This is the generation who's leading the charge in Congress, who the presidents of the day are. These are the folks who carry out the reforms that we've come to know as the Great Society, the War on Poverty, et cetera, et cetera. So this greatest generation, as I argue in my book, was the most progressive generation in American history.
Most definitely. I think that gives a very clear picture of the arc and of the generation itself. So let's talk a little bit about the policy, FDR's policy, and the policy that kind of shaped America. You say that FDR broadened the we in we the people. What did you mean by that?
FDR and those who we come to think of as the greatest generation. As you know from reading the book, most people think of the book as about FDR. As soon as you see a presidential name, you think it's just about a president. But thankfully, you asked me, first of all, about the greatest generation. And the expansion of the we and we the people is carried out by both of them. So let's take these kinds of things as examples. During the 1930s, historians love to fault Roosevelt on the question of race. And I don't think there's any doubt that we would all wish that Roosevelt had been even more effective in addressing what we came to call civil rights in the 30s. But in the meantime, let's not forget that when he enacted the policies of the New Deal, of economic recovery, the policies of economic reconstruction, all the public works projects, and indeed the policies of reform, that these policies as he envisioned them, the bills that he proposed and then were enacted, the agencies he established, these did not, from the presidential vantage point, have anything built into them that would have denied equality of race and ethnicity. I mean, for Roosevelt, this was actually a moment to enlarge the we in we the people. But of course, making its way through Congress, whether we're talking about the Social Security or the National Labor Relations Act, Southern Democrats, who chaired most of the committees at this time, who were overwhelmingly white supremacists and Jim Crow segregationists, they were very happy to enact the New Deal as long as they could figure out ways of reducing the black presence in it, or in many ways marginalizing the black presence in it. So, for example, they couldn't legislate racialist laws or racist laws, but they could exclude categories of occupations. And Southern Democrats were very effective in forcing the Roosevelt administration to accept the exclusion of agricultural workers and household workers from the original Social Security Act, and similarly in the National Labor Relations Act. This was not at all Roosevelt's ambitions. Roosevelt's ambitions was to have Social Security and laws protecting and empowering workers that would have guaranteed the same rights to all Americans. But here's the other thing. Roosevelt himself, in his administration, set an example of what America might become. He brought in the very first woman cabinet officer, Frances Perkins, to head up the Department of Labor. He brought in Harold Ickes, who was actually a progressive Republican, to head up the Department of Interior. And Ickes had very, very close ties to both the African-American community in Chicago and Western Native American communities on the reservations, and had headed up the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, in Chicago for a while in the early, I think it was the early 1920s. So Roosevelt brought in this figure who actually in many ways represented, though not himself black, the possibility of addressing questions of race and ethnicity. Similarly, in the second year of the administration, he brought Henry Morgenthau to become Secretary of the Treasury, the second Jewish American ever to hold a cabinet level position. And then below those offices, he recruited figures who were themselves eager to bring in, and did bring in to the ranks of the administration for the first time ever, African Americans, and more Jewish and Catholic. Up until the 1930s, this had been what, people think of as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation. And the Roosevelt administration really did open government up, the federal government at least, opened it up to Jews, Catholics, and people of color in a way not before seen ever in the United States. I mean, Roosevelt really did in many ways signal the possibilities in American life of enlarging the country in a fashion that would make it more than just a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation. Now, on the other hand, if you don't mind my going on.
Sure.
Working people of the day, however racist or anti-Semitic or anti-Catholic many of them may have been, it is the case that they organized labor unions, the industrial unions, and they had as a fundamental law rule inside the organizing of these unions that they would not abide racism or, for that matter, sexism. And they actually brought in, they integrated, significantly integrated the union ranks in the 1930s. United Steelworkers and others. I mean, I could go on. But the fact is that all of a sudden, black and white workers and Latino workers in the Southwest are compelled to fight together as opposed to fight each other. It didn't end racism by any means, but it really did begin this transformation and understanding of the we and we the people. The Civilian Conservation Corps, which recruited 3 million young men from their teenage years through their 20s, to go out and fight soil erosion, to plant trees, to really transform the American landscape in dramatic ways, to build parks, help build roads. These guys, when they came into these camps, had to all of a sudden deal with folks they had never before encountered. So Italian Americans from New York and Jewish Americans from New York are all of a sudden dealing with Irish Americans from Chicago and German Americans from St. Louis. And in fact, many of them, by way we could tell from the letters that they wrote, is that they were coming to realize what it was to be an American, that they were more than just, you know, Italian or Jewish or German or Irish or whatever else. 3 million young men, many of whom would end up in the army in World War II. In essence, they're leading the way towards that, what are they, sort of multi-ethnic bomber crew, multi-ethnic tank crew, the multi-ethnic infantry. People don't realize how significant the 30s experience was in changing the we and we the people.
Most definitely. It was a melting pot on many different levels and in many different ways. It seems that the fight against oligarchy really took its power then. So you base a lot of your book about a famous speech that was given by FDR, and it was delivered at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, which happens to be where the DNC convention is being held this year.
Right, 80 years from that date. The 36 speech is crucial to Roosevelt's politics. Everything in Roosevelt's speech making, I can take you from 32 all the way through close to his death, it was always in many ways this same theme. And 41, the Four Freedoms, is, I think, in many ways the greatest, the finest articulation of the very same theme.
You base a lot of your book, a speech that was given in 1941 by FDR, laid out the four freedoms. And the four freedoms are fundamental, as you say, kind of the crux of our society and what we should aim for. So let's go through them a little bit and talk about them in historical terms and also relating them to the current political climate. So the first is freedom of speech and expression. Tell me a little
right.
about that.
Well, in the way he presented it in these four freedoms, and freedom of speech and expression is first. When people hear freedom of speech and expression, they obviously think, I hope they think, of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. You know, the First Amendment to the Constitution, the first of the Bill of Rights. Freedom of speech and press and assembly. And in many ways, that's what he had in mind. And his vision, by the way, as he projected in the Four Freedoms, it would be not only for the United States, but for the world. Although when Americans heard it, they embraced it as a vision for the United States. And in many ways, people say, well, you know, the first freedom of speech and expression was something we had already achieved. But that's not at all the case, okay? There were many people who were incapacitated, who were excluded, who, by way of Jim Crow laws in the South or various forms of cultural segregation in the North, were excluded from the capacity to exercise freedom of speech and expression. The other thing is that freedom of speech and expression not only refers to your ability to stand on a street corner and speak your mind or write a letter to the editor or write an op-ed piece, it obviously also had to do with the idea that workers themselves, working people themselves, should have a voice in the workplace. This was fundamental to the Roosevelt administration's 12 years, and that is, as they called it then, industrial democracy, that workers should have the right to organize unions and collectively bargain with their employers, and thus we create beginnings of industrial democracy. So when Roosevelt spoke freedom of speech and expression and people heard this, they may each have heard it in their own way. So African-Americans in the South imagined that the Roosevelt administration was making a promise that in time we were going to bring an end to Jim Crow segregation and white supremacy. Working people, both union and those who aspire to be in unions, may well have heard a commitment to the idea that industrial democracy, we had only begun to fight, you might say, for industrial democracy. So freedom of speech and expression was not just a reiteration of the First Amendment. It actually did project in many people's imaginations, with good reason, given that what had happened in the previous 8 years during the Depression years, that these were promises to be pursued and expanded to enhance American democracy. And freedom of speech and expression was the first.
Fantastic. And the second is the freedom of every person to worship God in his or her own way.
Right. And this, of course, was a clear signal that the United States was opposed to the policies of Nazi Germany. That's the first and foremost statement. Also was to say that we also remain committed to opposing any nation state that denied people the freedom of conscience and the freedom to worship as they please. But here in the United States, it was also heard as not just a reiteration of freedom of religion as stated in the First Amendment to the Constitution, that first Bill of Rights. It was also an understanding that we were not going to allow people who were not of a major faith, the major faith was Protestantism, but we were not going to allow for religious discrimination. So Jewish Americans heard that as a promise that the federal government in the future would not abide at the possibility that in Boston, where it was happening, or the streets of Brooklyn, that Irish Catholic thugs would beat up on Jewish elderly or Jewish children. It meant that in Indiana, the Ku Klux Klan would not burn crosses on black or Catholics' front lawns. I mean, it really was a statement that not only were we reiterating the fundamental, you know, you had the right to worship as you please or not worship at all, but also that the country would not abide religious persecution and discrimination on the part of private groups from the KKK to Father Coughlin's Catholic thugs. So freedom of worship spoke very directly to Americans in the great majority, in fact.
Right, right. And it still does. The third is economic security, freedom from want. So
yeah.
what was he describing there? I mean, especially at that time in history.
Well, you can imagine that after 8 years of the New Deal efforts to fight the Depression, that Americans understood that the Roosevelt administration and the nation were going to remain committed to pursuing the projects of the New Deal, to reduce poverty, to provide jobs for all, to make sure that people didn't go to bed hungry or without shelter. In fact, Roosevelt himself, before he even stated these four freedoms, told Americans, if we're going to prepare for defense and if we're going to prepare for the possibility of war, then we ought not to sacrifice all that we've accomplished during the New Deal in combating poverty and inequality and in ensuring workers' rights in the workplace and so on and so forth. So when they heard freedom from want, they knew that Roosevelt was recommitting his presidency and the nation to pursuing the battle against poverty and inequality. Now, freedom from want was really significant. It was a reiteration of those 8 years of the New Deal, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And the fourth war, freedom from fear, from acts of aggression. What was he really trying to ingrain into America?
Right. Yeah. This was a statement on his part that was to say that, you know, we're not in the war yet, but we must create a defense industry that is able to both provide us with the materials for defense, but also bolster Britain's efforts at withstanding the Nazi blitzkrieg. Basically, this was, I have to tell you that in many ways, even though this was framed as a freedom from fear, a defense notion, this was very much a part of Roosevelt's call to arms, the four freedoms, and this one was that. But what he was saying in the full statement of the freedom from fear at first was that we would fight for a war in which there would be peace, and that would be the priority of nations, and also that we would guarantee that peace, and he really was a supporter of an idea of a United Nations and disarmament. But again, Americans heard it not only in terms of world peace and that they would participate in the creation of it, but even more fundamentally, again, the idea that they would not have to go to bed in fear. So African Americans down south heard this as, again, a statement that they would not be subject to the kinds of white supremacist activities that ever since Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, they had been suffering. And again, Jewish Americans would not fear for their lives on the streets of Boston or anywhere else, that Catholics, and don't forget, anti-Catholicism was rampant during the 1930s in many places. Mm-hmm. People understood this as an assurance that you would not only have economic security, but you would have personal and family security. And it really did motivate Americans. You know, those are terribly unfulfilled promises, and we fight on for them.
We do. And the ideology and the programs that were founded, Social Security, labor unions, during that period of time, during his tenure, I mean, they have proved to be of great benefit to the American people. Why were they and why do they remain so controversial?
Well, the first thing to remember is, of course, and I'll point out, when he gave the speech, it was the state, basically the State of the Union message of 1941. When he gave the speech, Samuel Grafton, who was a leading columnist for the newspaper, the New York Post, which was then a very liberal newspaper, and similarly Eleanor Roosevelt, both noted the fact that Republicans did not applaud freedom from want and freedom from fear, and it seemed as if the Southern Democrats were not applauding freedom from fear. I mean, they heard that speech as a promise for a more social democratic, and that is not only a civil and political democratic America, but a social democratic America, and an America which would not abide segregation in the South. So there were those who didn't applaud, though I have to tell you, the applause was so, and I've listened to the tapes over and over, the applause was so loud, you wouldn't have known there were those who didn't applaud at the time. But those who were in the room could tell when people sat on their hands, they could see it happening. Well, during the war, business, most business leaders came to realize that they could not openly oppose the vision of the Four Freedoms. And they gave speeches before business groups and organizations. They say, look, we have to get on board with this idea. Americans have embraced this, and all we'll do is alienate people if we try to oppose it. So what they did was, in various ways, is they tried to co-opt the idea of the Four Freedoms and turn it into freedom from want, into kind of a pro-business kind of thing, that, you know, business can answer the question of American needs. And during the war, that it's business that's going to take the lead in the war effort. There were, however, those who still felt uncomfortable with the idea of freedom from want and freedom from fear as a possible lever to be used in regulating business and controlling business all the more in the future. So they spoke of the need for a fifth freedom, freedom of enterprise, or freedom of private enterprise, more specifically, as a fifth freedom, which, by the way, was never enacted. I mean, it never came to be part of the popular imagination, but it was repeated over and over again by business people. Well, after the war, I mean, Americans really did believe in pursuing those four freedoms. By the way, in 1943, Roosevelt had some surveys, polls conducted by the National Opinion Research Commission, and he had the surveys ask Americans what they wanted to pursue as public policies after World War, when the war came to an end. And what they discovered, what the White House discovered, was approximately 85% of Americans wanted such things as national health care, scholarships for college, basically guaranteeing high school and college education, public works projects so that every American had a right to work. The original meaning of right to work was basically that every American would be guaranteed a job, even if it meant the public action would carry it out, meaning, you know, federal government would pursue public works projects. I mean, Americans wanted to turn the Four Freedoms into guarantees in the post-war era. And it motivated Roosevelt, on seeing these results, to give another very famous State of the Union message in January of 44, in which he laid out an economic Bill of Rights to be added to the original Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. And this Bill of Rights would have given, if you like, oh, it would have actually guaranteed what the Four Freedoms was promising. Well, business did not like the idea of an economic Bill of Rights, okay? And after the war, they campaigned heavily against Harry Truman's efforts to legislate national health care. This is serious. Americans, 85% of Americans wanted national health care after World War II. Harry Truman, who became president on Roosevelt's death, one of his first initiatives was to call for national health care. Well, business opposed it vehemently, and they spent millions opposing creating national health care. And the American Medical Association opposed it. They didn't want to be regulated by government. They opposed it. In fact, they had always opposed the idea of national health care. And then Southern Democrats, they didn't oppose the idea of national health care as long as it could be limited to whites. They didn't want national health care because they were convinced that hospitals would have to be integrated and that doctors could not turn away black patients. So against their own better, you know, against the interests of the great majority of Southerners who were terribly poor, they opposed national health care. And by the way, all the way through the 1950s, Americans continued to support the idea of national health care, at least to the tune of greater than 50%. But business regularly set out to crush these programs that would have made the Four Freedoms all the more real. And they also did their damnedest to sort of promote a memory of World War II and what it was about that excluded the memory of Roosevelt's call for the Four Freedoms. the Democrats retreated somewhat, which was basically a Cold War thing. McCarthyism had come after the New Deal, had come after New Dealers, had attacked the idea of freedom from want and freedom from fear. Though, oddly enough, conservatives believed with Eisenhower they'd get to reverse the entire New Deal. But Eisenhower wasn't quite the conservative they imagined. So he actually pursued no efforts to turn back the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And he had two brothers, Eisenhower, one of whom was a liberal and the other of whom was an arch conservative. And the arch conservative wrote to him and said, what are you doing? I mean, why aren't you pursuing all these things we conservatives have talked about? And Eisenhower made it clear to people that he was sure, absolutely sure, given what his GIs had fought for. Hell, he had led them in World War II. What they had fought for, there was no way that they would ever tolerate getting rid of Social Security, the rights of workers, subsidies to farmers to sustain family farms. I mean, any political party that wants to go after the New Deal legacy will never be heard from again in this country.
Absolutely.
So as a consequence, Eisenhower, well, the Eisenhower administration, full of its conservatism, actually expanded Social Security to include those folks who had been left out, the agricultural workers. And later, of course, I mean, he pursues a number of other projects, such as the Interstate Highway system, which originally was a Roosevelt plan during the pre-war and then especially during the war years. It is, in many ways, the biggest public works project ever in American history.
It is.
Well, anyhow, but it's the case that conservatives and business executives and others did their damnedest to try to reverse the New Deal. And, of course, since most Americans had in spirit fought for them, they didn't want to reverse them. This was their new America, and they were prepared to at least defend them. However silenced the political left was, it remained the case that the Four Freedoms and legacy of the New Deal, and even, don't forget, the GI Bill was the greatest welfare program in American history, and it enabled 12 million veterans to make more of themselves and more of the nation after the war. And I think the fulfillment of that, that's why I said at the very outset that the greatest generation is not just World War II, and for that matter, it's not just the New Deal years and fighting the Great Depression. It's also the 1960s. So think about what goes on in the 60s in terms of civil rights and voting rights. So a generation that may not have pushed as hard as it did without the pushing from a younger generation, their own children, civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, over and over again, we see in the 1960s, in many ways, a greater fulfillment of the Four Freedoms, of the projects of the New Deal, and the generation that's enacting them and paying for them and leading the efforts to realize them in the end are the very folks who were in the CCC, who were, involved in the WPA and PWA, all these works projects as young men and women. Now they're voting for candidates, Kennedy and Johnson, who want to fulfill the ambitions of Roosevelt, you might say.
Sure. And so these ideas that were once viewed as radical, they came to fruition and they were ingrained in the American psyche. And so they seem so deeply ingrained. And yet a lot of what we're talking about, building infrastructure and, quote, entitlement spending, these are things that we're hearing a lot on the campaign trail right now. And they are being described as radical ideas. So how did things devolve from the 1960s?
Well, it's funny. During the 70s, there was this sense of the 60s were coming to an end. Things were seen more politically quiet. But in fact, in a certain fashion, all hell broke loose in the 1970s, because this was the time in which conservatives really do take charge by the end of the decade of the Republican Party. Their first victories were in the early 60s with Barry Goldwater. And with Reagan, they secured a remarkable coalition that by the end of the decade in the 70s has taken control of the party. But even before that, in 1971, 72, business people become absolutely convinced that they are under siege because of all of the regulations that are enacted in the 70s about the environment, about consumer safety, and about workplace safety. Business corporations, these executives, are convinced that that, you know, democracy is dangerous. And then an organization founded by David Rockefeller, specifically for the idea of tempering American enthusiasms and lowering Americans' expectations, a group which, as soon as you name them, everyone thinks you're talking about a conspiracy. But it was not a conspiracy. It was, in fact, an open organization of European, Japanese, and American political and business leaders called the Trilateral Commission. And one of their earliest reports was called The Crisis of Democracy, in which they call for a tempering of democratic enthusiasms. And they actually name the groups in this report: labor unions, women's aspirations, the aspirations of the poor, academics, media people, that all of these folks, they're demanding too much, that there's a distemper of democracy. And business people organized in brand new ways. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce and National Association of Manufacturers had been around for decades, and they revved up their activities. But the leading corporate executives and financial leaders in this country created a new organization called the Business Roundtable. And the only people who could belong to this organization were chief executives of the top Fortune 500 companies. And if they were going to belong, they had to commit to personally taking part in lobbying activities. That is, if business was threatened in any way by some new legislation, they would all get in their Learjets and fly to Washington. And they did exactly that in the late 70s to challenge the efforts, again, at expanding consumer safety, labor rights, and so on. So business mobilized and began to spend huge sums of money on think tanks, on public campaigns, on magazines that they created to combat workers' rights, to combat regulations over business, really to turn back the clock to a moment, say, before the 1960s. And then further to the right, the most conservative business folks who ended up underwriting the likes of the Reagan campaigns, their ambitions were to go back to the time before the 1930s, to a Gilded Age kind of capitalism. So you had the American Enterprise Institute, which really was ideas for business to sort of turn over the changes of the 60s regarding business regulations and workers' rights. But then you had the Cato Institute, the far more libertarian institute, that was eager to go back to not only the days before the New Deal, but even the days before the capital P progressivism of the early 20th century, which, you know, regulated business in terms of food safety and pharmaceuticals and things like that. So there was this mobilization from above. A declaration of class war was made on the part of business, and those who championed their cause were conservative Republicans. And sadly, the Democrats were so divided after the 1960s and the debacles of 68 and 72, and they were completely incapable of challenging the forces arrayed against them. Labor unions did their damnedest, but the Democratic Party did not come to their defense. It was tough times for liberals and progressives. And of course, it results in 1980 in the election of Ronald Reagan, and we get 12 years of Republican government. The Democrats could not seem to answer because they had moved themselves to the right, even though most Americans had remained somewhere center left. And I think the greatest tragedy was that the Democrats turned their backs. Carter turned his back, Jimmy Carter, on the Roosevelt legacy. He actually launched the deregulation and denied reforming workers' rights and literally turned his back on consumer rights as well, and paved the way for Ronald Reagan to do what he did during the 1980s. It was amazing, as Reagan himself had been a New Deal Democrat back in the 1930s and 1940s. So he knew all about, in fact, he often quoted Roosevelt against Roosevelt, which was terrible. I'm laughing because after all these years, I can still hear it. And in fact, in the Democratic Party, there arose a rather conservative force known as the Democratic Leadership Council, and they succeeded in championing the victory in 1992 of Bill Clinton to the nomination and then to the presidency. So Democrats have retreated all these 40 years from the Roosevelt legacy. However, it's been very interesting this year. If we go back a year, Hillary Clinton launched her campaign for the nomination at Four Freedoms Park, which is the FDR Memorial in New York that had opened in 2012 to remember Franklin Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms. And she made it a point of launching her campaign there. And then Bernie Sanders, the even more progressive Democrat, made it a point of explaining what he meant by democratic socialism when he went to Georgetown University, and he said that Franklin Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights speech of 1944 as what he meant by democratic socialism, and then he referred equally to Martin Luther King, who was in fact a democratic socialist. So, you know, you had this recovery, at least the beginnings of a recovery on the part of leading Democrats of the Roosevelt tradition, the Roosevelt legacy. Not by accident. It's not that, you know, they had some what they call catharsis. It's because if you think about the past few years, Americans themselves and Democrats at the grassroots have been making demands on the part of their own party, saying, look, we need a hike in the minimum wage. We need far more protection of workers' rights. We need protection of African Americans, freedom from fears. Look, Black Lives Matter is about freedom from fear. The Fight for 15 is about freedom from want.
Right. You know, well, and the divide between neoliberal and liberal ideology, it never really went away. And it seems that publicly the party embraced neoliberalism. And what you're saying, what I'm hearing is that the liberals are now standing up and saying, wait a second, we're still here.
You know, thank you, Shannon, for reminding me of the term neoliberalism. It took me a long time to use that term because it conjured up a whole different set of things to me. But yes, neoliberalism, which begins with Jimmy Carter, and actually, for all of his good deeds as president and accomplishments, also characterized much of the Obama administration. In 2011, when pressed by, it begins in 2010, when pressed by conservative Republicans to do something about deficit reduction and, you know, raising the cap on the, what's it called, on the national debt, whatever it was.
Oh, yes.
The fact
yes.
That all of a sudden Obama, instead of defending the Roosevelt tradition, he all of a sudden started speaking as if he were a Republican. He talked about the need for government to live within its means. And then he appointed that commission, the Fiscal Responsibility Commission. So neoliberalism even found its way into the Obama administration, an administration that promised, yes, we can, and then too often said, no, we can't.
Right, right. Well, and our country is so divided and there is so much partisanship and so much gridlock that compromise and cooperation is imperative but difficult to find. And so I find it interesting that in the Democratic Party platform, there is now a large influence of Bernie Sanders and his campaign and his ideas. And it will be interesting to see going forward whether they stick with that, because it seems like we're still fighting for those four freedoms.
Yes, it does. You and I have talked about this convention of 1936 when Roosevelt delivered what I think is the most radical speech ever delivered by an American president in accepting the nomination for a second term. And here we are returning to Philadelphia today in July. And we'll have Hillary Clinton receiving the nomination, and I assume Bernie Sanders delivering some kind of keynote address at the convention. And oh, how I would love to see some means by which Bernie and Hillary both blatantly, openly, you know, really do reach back into American history and lay claim, not just to the Roosevelt tradition, which Democrats can easily do. I would like to see all the way back to the man who first envisioned an independent United States, and that's Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense and the Crisis Papers back in 1776, because we are the pioneers of social democracy. We may not think of ourselves that way, but Americans are the pioneers of social democracy. And if after we won the American Revolution, Thomas Paine needed to raise money for a project he had in mind of building an iron bridge in Philadelphia, went back to Europe to try to raise funds for this, and ends up getting caught up in and becoming a leading figure in the French Revolution. Well, in the wake of the French Revolution, in the mid to late 1790s, Thomas Paine, his very last famous and important pamphlet titled Agrarian Justice, and before that was a pamphlet that was titled Rights of Man. In those two pamphlets, he is the first leading figure in modern history to project, to actually lay out the possibility of Social Security. And he first states it in Rights of Man and then elaborates upon it in Agrarian Justice. And what he says is, we have to figure out a way to combat poverty. And if we can get rid of aristocracies and monarchies, we're going to have monies and moreover, tax the landed rich. We'll have monies. We can create national funds. And national funds can be used to provide pensions to the elderly. And then he goes on and actually proposes that boys and girls, when they reach the age of maturity, that they should receive a payment out of the fund that will enable them to make a living, to make their way in the world. They can use it for education, buying a farm, setting up a business. This is the first real call for social democracy. And this is in the 1790s by an American revolutionary.
That's amazing.
Yes, isn't it? And then think about Abraham Lincoln. We rightly remember him as leading the victory in the Civil War. And we also remember him as the great emancipator, though obviously slaves took part in their own emancipation. But the fact is, we often forget that Lincoln himself signed into law the Homestead Act, a great social democratic act to try and afford all families that wanted to set themselves up in the Midwest with a family farm. He also signed the Land Grant Act, in which the federal government gave federal lands to the states to be used to set up state universities. So the great state universities of, say, University of Wisconsin, Rutgers University in New Jersey, and others, these are all due to social democratic initiatives signed into law by Abraham Lincoln, who I think we need to recover as something of a social democrat. What we find is right through American history, this story of social democracy really originates in the United States, not in the minds of European reformers. They embraced these things, but in fact, we were the ones who pioneered it. And Social Security, which begins in 1935 in law in the United States, was originally supposed to include health care as well, but the AMA and business opposed it, and Roosevelt wanted to make sure at least the basic Social Security was enacted. Over and over again, Social Security, health care, college grants, the building of the nation, we paved the way to social democracy. So it would be great if the Democrats laid hold of that American history and reminded Americans of what truly makes America great.
Yes, yes, most definitely. And I do, it seems that there is an aspect of this that people, businesses feel like they're under siege. And there's also a societal rising of racism and sexism and xenophobia. And I think yes. A lot of people feel that their security is being threatened by any social programs. And they're really trying to, it seems, take that last breath of being the oligarchy and having a sense of power. It's very strong right now. And so how can we overcome that?
My ambition, my aspirations from the time I entered into writing back in the 70s and 80s was basically to write in such a way as to remind Americans of just who they are. And I think that politicians need to remind Americans of just who they are. You know, when the likes of a Trump talk about American greatness and then somehow equate that with the ability to build a wall, to round up Muslims and deport them. When they talk about these things, I think, how does that ever connect to American greatness? American greatness has to do with the fight, the struggle for those four freedoms, for what we think of as the Bill of Rights. I mean, that's what makes America great. You know, when was the United States at its greatest? When we won a revolution and created a democracy? Was it the Civil War when we finally got it together and carried out a second revolution, you know, in which slaves were emancipated? Was it at the time of the New Deal when we mobilized and fought for social democracy and industrial democracy? Was it World War II when we literally beat fascism and Japanese militarism in order to pursue those four freedoms? Was it in the 1960s when we enacted civil rights, voting rights, immigration reform? I mean, those were our greatest moments.
Most definitely. And I think we have the potential to go in that direction. And I'm wondering what made you want to write this book? What inspired you to bring the four freedoms at this point to America through your book?
Well, it started really in the 1990s. I was really astonished when remember the Greatest Generation phenomena just exploded and really did lead to some really beautiful monuments being built, to beautiful memorial occasions, to wonderful books being produced and films. I mean, in many ways, I marveled at all of the efforts for us to remember the Greatest Generation and to honor the millions who, at that time, who were still alive and might be able to appreciate our honoring them. But what I couldn't get over is repeatedly, whether it was the filmmakers or the writers, otherwise excellent writers, or even the occasions that people gathered, is they seemed to distance the New Deal years from World War II. So they failed to see the degree to which this was all part of one generation's experience. But what really upset me is, as I read the books and I saw the films and even the documentaries, even Ken Burns, there was no reference to the four freedoms. Why do these young men and women, in 16 million of them, 350,000 of the 16 million were women, what gave them motivation and the courage? What inspired them to pursue the war for the four freedoms? And indeed, it was the possibility of really pursuing them and realizing them all the more after the war. And as I said, 85% of Americans wanted the kinds of things that were promised in those four freedoms. So no mention of this, even there wasn't even a mention of FDR giving the four freedoms speech. You know, this is outrageous. Somebody's got to do something. So I actually proposed to my editor, Dennis Frost-Joss and Giroux. I said, you know, I'd really like to do a book on the Four Freedoms speech. And he said, after some deliberation, he said, you know what, that's a really good idea. But how about if you include what's been on your mind, make it FDR, the Four Freedoms, and the Greatest Generation. So I was able to bring together sort of that my interest in that speech, my interest in that generation. I had written something about my father. My father served in World War II. Was in the 11th Armored Division and fought in the Battle of the Bulge. And I had written something about that. And he said, bring this all together and do a book about that. Make it a bigger book. And then as we got into it, he said, and then answer these questions. What happened to the Four Freedoms after the war? So there's that arc. And then, I use a four-letter word, Shannon.
Sure.
He said, this was the question he posed to me. What the fuck happened? you know what? I remember he and I were sitting in a cafe in New York. And he said to me, you know, Harvey, if we could get away with it, I'd like to title the book, What the Fuck Happened? and I said, yeah, I'd like to too, but it's not going to happen. And then he played with the idea, should we do the final chapter? Is that? No. So we backed off. So the question was, tell me about the Four Freedoms and the Greatest Generation. And then, you know, what the hell happened? That was
right.
that whole thing. So it
meshed. I mean, the subject matter comes together perfectly. So I think you were.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, and I highly recommend to anyone out there to read this book. It's called The Fight for the Four Freedoms by Harvey J. Kay. And you're writing this book and the Bernie Sanders campaign. I really think that there is an awareness, a consciousness of the need to bring these back to American society and American culture. And perhaps now is the time for that.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been great.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much for talking with me. I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network to kick off the summer season of The Authentic Woman. My guest has been the wonderful Harvey J. Kay, and you can find him on Twitter at Harvey J. Kay, K-A-Y-E. And I hope that you buy and read Harvey's book, because I think it offers a really great perspective on American history as it relates to American politics today. So until next time, have a good one.